Welcome to the Wine Atelier Podcast, your insider's guide to mastering wine with certified sommelier Stephanie Miskew.
Hey there, wine lovers. Thanks so much for tuning in today for week three of Rosé Month here on the Wine Atelier Podcast. And once again, I am super excited because I have another very special guest with me today. I have Mitch Frank, news editor for Wine Spectator magazine. Welcome, Mitch.
Hey, Stephanie. Thanks.
Oh, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today. I so appreciate it. And I just have to say, you know, it was funny how this interview came about. The other day I was, you know, it's been rosé month, right? So I've had rosé on my mind kind of constantly, which is not a bad thing. And I opened my mailbox, and just bringing in the mail, and you weed through all the catalogs, but there under the catalogs was the most beautiful cover I've ever seen. At the top, it had rosé and big bold letters and beautiful bottles. And I was instantly smitten. Of course, I was just, oh, it was beautiful. And I'm happy to report to all of you listeners, Mitch is actually the author of the cover story, Rosé's New Era, it's the June 30th issue of Wine Spectator magazine. So it's the current one on the shelves, right?
Yes, just arriving now.
Great. And in it, not only is the cover beautiful, but in it, you just do such an amazing job of beautifully explaining kind of what led up to the rosé revolution here and how this pink wine has just risen to, crazy levels of popularity, right?
Yeah, it's been an amazing transition for rosé. When you think about 20 years ago, when Americans didn't take rosé very seriously, when rosé was passé, and now suddenly, yeah, we're becoming a rosé drinking country, consuming 20% of the global rosé supply every year.
Wow. And the other numbers you mentioned that just blew my mind were, I think you have here White Zinfandel sales are down almost 2%. Sales of imported rosé jumped 44%. And you also included since 2001, sales of Provençal rosé are up 4,852%.
It's pretty stunning. And Provence has been kind of leading that revolution. And if you think about it, Provence has always been about rosé for decades. It just kind of lends itself. You have a terroir that's great for red grapes, but you have a place where it's pretty hot to be drinking red wine year round. So rosé is a natural. But really, they've worked pretty hard in the past two decades to improve the quality. To make rosé not just kind of an afterthought. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why it's appealing to so many of us.
Right. And that kind of leads to my next question. So you actually wrote Wine Spectator's last cover story on rosé in 2007, right?
Yeah, we might have been a little ahead of the curve then.
You're ahead of your time. Nothing wrong with that. So what do you think, in your opinion, since you've had your finger on the pulse of rosé for so long, what are the main factors that have really led to this amazing surge in sales and interest in rosé?
Well, it's multiple factors. Like I mentioned, the improvement in quality of rosé that we're seeing. There's always been rosé, but for a lot of wine regions, it's been a byproduct of making red wine. Mm-hmm. It's been, where they bleed some juice off the tank early on to make their red wine more concentrated. Right. And so the rosé that's left over is kind of a byproduct. Now you have winemakers who see money to be made in rosé, really, picking the grapes when they're at the optimum ripeness for rosé specifically, mm-hmm. and treating it carefully in the winery. And then you have consumer taste. You have the fact that in the aftermath of the Great Recession, people are looking for affordable luxury. They want to treat themselves, but they don't want to spend as much. And rosé kind of fit that bill. It's a wine, but you don't have to take it too seriously and you don't have to spend too much.
Well said. I love that term, affordable luxury. Exactly, because I think with rosé, right, it does bring that little bit of glamour, the luxury, that kind of feeling with it too. So affordable luxury is a good thing.
And you mentioned our cover, how many other wines come in clear bottles where the color of the wine inside is a selling point?
Well said. I know, it couldn't be more beautiful. Looking at a lineup of rosé, like, it gets those endorphins going before you even open the bottle. It's such a beautiful wine, too. And you actually just mentioned a few minutes ago, every episode, every podcast episode, I really like to kind of demystify one particular term for my listeners out there. And you mentioned that technique of kind of bleeding off the, you know, the juice from the process of making a red wine. And you, can you tell us a little bit about what that's called and what it is exactly?
Yeah, that's saignée. Mm-hmm. And it's technically, you know, it's the French term basically to bleed. And you're bleeding off a little of that juice, which has only been on the grape skins for, you know, less than a day, sometimes just a couple of hours. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's really kind of a red wine making technique. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, you're bleeding off a little bit of the juice, you're leaving some behind, and the juice that's left behind, there's a lot more skins, you know, per ounce of juice. Mm-hmm. So you're getting a lot more of that tannin and that color, and you're making a richer red wine. But it's not really optimum for the rosé that you're making.
Right. So mark that word, folks, saignée, and I will list that in the resource guide as well. So then how does this compare to the way rosé is being made today?
Well, today, producers who are really focused on quality, they're picking the grapes earlier. Mm-hmm. Because if you think about rosé, it kind of marries the best of red and white wine. You're taking kind of a little bit of the fruit and flavors of red wine, and you're adding kind of the vibrance and the acidity of white. So you want to pick those grapes earlier when they have a little more acidity left in them, and you're going to make sure you get that freshness. And then you're going to leave them on the skins, not based on, you know, bleeding them off and making the red wine, but leaving them just enough to get enough of that red fruit character and enough of that color. And it depends a lot on which kind of grapes you use, which is part of the fun. There's so much variety of rosé.
Absolutely. I think that is fascinating. I think one of the things I run into a lot of my listeners or at events is that people think, oh, rosé, like it must be like Chardonnay or like a varietal wine, and that, you know, probably only one grape is used to make it. But you're right, like depending on the region, it could be any number of grapes, right?
Yeah, I mean, your traditional Provençal rosé, you're seeing a lot of Grenache and you're seeing a lot of Cinsault. Mm-hmm. You know, you might be seeing Syrah in some places. You might be seeing it's really whatever is local. So we're seeing a lot of Sonoma and Oregon Pinot Noir rosés.
Yes.
In Rioja in Spain, you're seeing Tempranillo. And in Sicily, you might be seeing, you know, Nero d'Avola or Chiaroscuro.
Absolutely. So in that respect, rosé is also a wine that reflects terroir and really reflects where it comes from, essentially.
Yeah, almost every region that's been making wine for a long time has its own rosé. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is just the stuff that the winemaker makes for fun so he can drink it in the summer, or she. Right. And now it's become a serious wine. And one of the fun things about it is to sample different regions and different grapes. And we offer several pages worth of reviews, rosés that we really like from multiple regions around the world.
Absolutely. And I was going to mention that is such a great resource. In addition to your article, there's a few pages of great rosé recommendations from at different price points from different regions all around the world. So for those of you listening, it is really an exceptional guide. And if you want to even have people over and sample rosés, you know, assign everyone a different region and have them bring a rosé from that particular region, and you'd really be amazed at the differences in these wines. So in addition to the article and the list in this issue, you also feature an interview with John Bon Jovi and his son, who just partnered with Gerard Bertrand and launched their own rosé. So how have celebrities getting into the rosé game affected its popularity? Do you think that's had a big, influence as well?
Oh, I think it's had a major impact. It gives it attention. And if you think about it, if you're a celebrity and you decide, okay, I've always wanted to make my own wine. Mm-hmm. Well, what's something that's fun and not too serious that you can invest a little bit of time and have some fun making it, partner with a very good winemaker like Gerard Bertrand, mm-hmm. and get your wine out there. So it's definitely, you know, when people think rosé, they think fun, and why not try the rosé that Brad Pitt makes in his
So true. And I've found that I think in years past, maybe celebrities weren't very discriminating about, you know, maybe the quality of wines or even other products, but it seems like lately, and especially with rosé, it seems like there's such quality in the bottle, like how he, John Bon Jovi partnered with Gerard Bertrand and Brad Pitt and the Perrin family, even Kathy Lee Gifford and the Scheid family with her gift wines. Their rosé is just delicious.
Yeah, well, it's no longer just a novelty they want to have in their house. They want to get it out there. So why wouldn't you partner with the best? And certainly winemakers are happy to partner with celebrities and get their name out there.
Yeah, it's kind of like it's beneficial for both sides, and it just does make it more fun, that's for sure.
The nice thing for us is that the quality of the wines has been pretty impressive because of that. Both the John Bon Jovi wine and the Brad Pitt Angelina Jolie wine, Miraval, have gotten outstanding scores from us in blind tastings.
Absolutely, which is so wonderful. Love to hear that. So here we are, rosé, so popular, right? It's just, we can't get enough of it. We're having shortages, it seems like, every year. So what are there any downsides or pitfalls for a category of wine to achieve such success, you know, kind of where rosé is right now?
Well, all you have to do is think about the last time rosé was really popular in America. It was White Zinfandel. Everybody had to have that exact same style. It had to be a little sweet, and it had to be a certain color. Mm-hmm. We're starting to see where Provençal rosé is the only style that people are looking for. And it can be a great style, but it's one particular type of rosé. It's one particular flavor. They make different styles and colors of rosé just in that part of France. So we don't want to have rosé limited. And right now, a lot of retailers and distributors and importers I know are telling me that if it's not that particular shade of pink, mm-hmm. not that flavor profile that comes from Provence, people aren't interested.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate because really there's so many, it's a spectrum, and there can be so many different delicious styles of rosé. So if somebody sees a wine that's maybe a little darker in color, that shouldn't, you know, scare them or make them not buy the bottle then, right?
It shouldn't scare them away. They should maybe check out a rating that we posted on it or talk to a retailer they trust and try a few different styles in a few different regions. Unfortunately, we're seeing some other regions kind of copy Provence. So it's important to support those rosés that are different as long as the quality is good.
True. And I have found like if someone who's generally more of a red wine drinker probably isn't going to like the same style of rosé that mostly a white wine drinker is going to like. Like I've served rosés, and it's funny, I get pushback, especially from the guys at my events. When they see me coming around with a pink bottle of wine, the look on their face, they get like the deer in headlights, the big eyes, like, oh no, don't you try to, you know. But luckily these wines really do speak for themselves, and even the ones that are a little more fuller bodied, I have found that my clients who like red wines do like the wines a little darker in color with a little more tannin, a little more personality, as I like to say.
Yeah, and there's plenty of regions that are offering that. If you think about not far from Provence is Tavelle. It's right across the river from Chateauneuf-du-Pape. They use a lot of the same grapes, but they're known for rosé. Mm-hmm. And it happens to be a deep orange, almost red, you know, they call it salmon-colored rosé.
Right.
And it's definitely a different style. It's definitely a little richer and a little more structured. The wonderful thing, rosé is very food friendly. So that's really one way to pitch it to your friends who might be a little skittish of something painted.
Very true. And luckily, most of the events I do are centered around food and wine. So, right, it's like they taste it, they love the taste, and then, right, and it pairs so beautifully with so many dishes. So that makes it very, that's another wonderful quality as well. But I couldn't agree with you more. So, and I know we talked about this a little bit before, since you too grew up here in South Florida, I'm a South Florida girl, I have to ask, what?
I was about to say go Dolphins.
Yeah, go Dolphins.
The Dolphins make me cry.
I know. Very sad. But I have to ask, what was your gateway rosé? I've been very open about the fact that the White Zinfandel of the 80s got me into the wine game. And, you know, I've evolved since then. But what was your first, you know, intro to rosé?
That's a great question. You know, I think I was scared of rosé when I first started getting into wine because I had always heard rosé is white zin. Right. You know,
girls like me drinking all the white zin.
Yeah, but the first time I had a bottle of Provençal style, it did open my eyes to its potential. I remember a great vibrance and minerality, which is something that I did not expect, and a real eye opener. You know, is probably the Lopez de Heredia. From Rioja, which is a deep kind of orange rosé and has been a fascinating style. And I said, wait a second, there's a lot of variety and interesting stuff here.
Wonderful. So, and I love that you just mentioned that particular wine. Outside of Provence, what are some of your favorite producers or other regions to look for, you know, some great rosés that have, you know, made a particular impression on you?
Well, I mentioned Tavel. I think that's a fantastic place to look. I think down in Sicily, they're doing some fascinating things. I think that Rioja, I also mentioned, and some parts of southern Spain. I really have been impressed with some Oregon Pinot Noir rosés that we're starting to see now.
Yes. Absolutely. And do you have any particular dishes or, you know, types of food that you like to pair with these wines?
Well, I live in New Orleans, so we like a lot of seafood. And there is nothing better I have found recently than having some rosé with a crawfish boil. I used to always think, okay, crawfish is for beer.
Right.
But I've been trying rosé with it, and it's been a real eye-opener.
Oh, I think I bet.
You throw some shrimp on the grill, and that would be great, too. So that's always fun.
No kidding. I wish I had that in front of me right now. That sounds delicious. I love asking all the people I interview that, because it really, you get such great ideas and, you know, seeing what other people love to enjoy as well. Let's see. If you were giving advice to consumers when they are out purchasing rosé, say they might be a little afraid, they're not that into rosé yet. What is one piece of advice you would give them when purchasing rosé? Say they're at their local either grocery store or retail store, they walk up to the wall of wine, you know, they're a little nervous, they're not sure which bottle to pick. What's some advice one thing you might tell them to look for when they're, you know, wanting to learn a little more about rosé?
I would say, first of all, do your homework. You know, don't always gravitate towards the cheapest wine on the shelf. It's true that you can get great value with rosé, but I find that if you're going to spend less than $10, you really have to do your homework ahead of time. We're starting to see a lot of lower priced rosés that are not necessarily the best on the market now.
I couldn't agree with you more on that. It seems like just bumping it up to between $15 and $20, it seems like the quality of what you get is so exponential, it's so much better. It's so much better. And I also love to drive home to my listeners, you know, you want to steer away from, I mean, people, we buy organic milk, we buy organic chicken, you know, we spend all this money to buy these types of products. But when it comes to wine, like, you know, there's that difference between kind of the industrially farmed and made wine and then the, you know, the wine that's made with a little more care and that's a little more sustainably farmed, that kind of thing. And I think you, and these wines, they don't have to be very expensive, but I think you're right when you get into kind of that $10 and less bottle. I don't know. I just think for a few extra bucks, I think it's worth it.
Well, and as you said, you don't have to go too high up to get great value from rosé.
Right.
There are great bottles for $15. It's not like certain varieties or certain regions, you know, you're going to have to spend $30, $40, $50 to get quality. Rosé, that's not the case.
Right.
So you just have to do a little bit of research. You can always refer to our magazine or if you want on your phone, our website or our app, Wine Ratings Plus.
Yes.
You can also find that retailer who you talk to and who listens to you and what you like and is willing to give you a few suggestions and take home and see what you think of what they suggested.
Absolutely. And that's another, you brought up another great resource if someone is standing there in the store or they're on their way. Tell us about your app. Is that something they could use to kind of guide them?
Wine Ratings Plus has a fantastic, easy way to reach all of our reviews. And you can, for a couple dollars a month, basically, it's available on the iPhone or Android. Mm-hmm. And you can have all the expertise of our senior editors who are tasting, you know, last year they tasted about 15,000 wines and reviewed them.
Wow. That's fantastic. And right, we don't all have time to bring the copy of the magazine with us, right? So wouldn't it be great to just have it there at your fingertips on the fly as you're kind of like trying to pick the right bottle?
Yeah, I get lost in front of the wall myself sometimes.
So, totally. Like if you're at, me too, if you're at a store you've never been at before, like you look up at the thing and you're right, you get the deer in headlights look like, okay, let me get oriented here. But yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Oh, and another question, and I think I was reading one of your great blog posts on the website. Corks versus screw caps. I've been very open about the fact that I'm a huge fan of screw caps. I think all wines should be sealed with a screw cap closure. So for people, I know even with rosé, and even though the wines aren't that expensive, still when people see that screw cap closure, they think, oh no, like my friends are going to think I got a cheap wine and I don't want to look like I don't know what I'm talking about. So what are your thoughts? If you want to tell my listeners a little bit about your thoughts on screw cap closures.
Well, you should tell your friends they're welcome because you brought a wine that you know won't be corked.
Exactly.
You know, the cork producers have done a really great job. They have invested a lot in reducing the amount of tainted corks that spoil wine. But it's not 100% safe.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that screw caps give you that guarantee that the wine is going to be fresh and taste like the winemaker intended it to be. So I really don't see why more producers don't use them. But I have spoken to producers who tell me, you know, winemakers who say, I tried it and mm-hmm. sales went down.
Yep.
Because we have it in our heads that if you don't pull a cork, it doesn't have that same experience, that romance, you know. My colleague Harvey Steinman suggested just make a cork popping sound with your mouth.
Exactly.
And your
True. You can download it on your iPhone or just play it as you crack the screw cap. So true. But I mean, right, that it's the romance of it. But when you pour that wine in your glass and it tastes like moldy cardboard, not right, not so romantic.
Well, the worst of all is when it's a very slight case of TCA, which is the chemical that causes cork taint.
Mm-hmm.
And so the wine just tastes kind of dull or kind of quiet. And so you don't realize that it's spoiled. You just mm-hmm. think it's not a very good wine.
Exactly. Therefore, you're not going to buy it again because, you know, if your friends are raving about it, recommending it, you're like, I don't get it. Right. And it was just that one bad bottle that, unfortunately, right, ruined your perception of that wine moving forward.
Amazon sent their products in boxes that ate the product inside 3% of the time, we wouldn't be buying from Amazon anymore.
Well said. No, I couldn't agree with you more. So for those of you out there, embrace the screw cap, whether it's rosé, whether it's, you know, any wine, and even especially, I mean, it's terrible when it happens, you know, to an everyday wine, but I mean, we've had it happen to wines. You know, you spend $100 on a bottle of wine, you wait 10 years to drink it, only to open it and find that it's corked. I mean, it's terrible. And now they've actually developed screw caps to let some oxygenation occur. And I hope in the future that screw cap eventually wins. So we shall see.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, we'll do another episode on that because it's such a fascinating topic. So, all right, let me see. So since I have you here, and I know we're coming to the end of our interview, you've got basically, you know, a dream job, editor at Wine Spectator. And I just wanted to ask you a little bit, because I know you have a long career as a journalist and a writer. And you actually made the move from a political reporter, right, to the food and wine world. Is that right?
That is correct. I was a nation reporter for Time Magazine for about 8 years. And politics will drive you to drink.
Yeah. Especially nowadays. Yes, it will. So true. So was that an easy transition, or was it a gradual one, or?
Wine had been a passion of mine since I was in college, and I got more and more into it over the years. You know, it was my hobby, but it was the kind of thing, all my vacations were in wine regions, and my wife and I had a wine of the month club where we had friends together to blind taste different varieties each month. And, you know, it just became a thing when, after the 2004 presidential election, I was looking for something new. My wife said, that's the magazine you actually read every month when it shows up. So thankfully, I work with some great people who have given me great opportunities, and I've learned so much in the time I've been with them.
Wonderful. And like we were talking about earlier, you kind of split your time between the website and the actual magazine, correct?
Yeah. As our news editor, I edit our online news coverage and also the news that goes in the front of the magazine. And it's great because I really love the chance to engage with our readers, no matter where they're getting the info from.
No kidding. And I would like to encourage all of you listening. I know many of you already read the magazine, but I mean, winespectator.com is just a treasure trove of great information. It really is. And I loved, you know, check out Mitch's blog posts there. It seemed like all the most relevant topics, burning questions and topics you want to know about, you've written something on. So I hope people take the time to go on and check your work out, because it's really fantastic.
Thanks so much.
Of course. And let's end on a rosy note. What do you see kind of for the future of rosé right now? You know, there's a lot going on in the marketplace, but like, do you see rosé kind of sustaining this growth or plateauing? You know, where do you see rosé headed in the next, I don't know, 5-10 years?
Oh, I see two possibilities. I think the dangerous possibility is that this is just another wave of rosé, and that it's going to kind of die down for a while. We're seeing so much rosé in the market and so many trends, everything to frosé. But what I hope happens is that we've just kind of entered in America our teenage years of rosé appreciation. Not that I'm encouraging teenagers to try rosé, but we're just kind of getting to that stage where we're like, okay, we like this. Now let's explore more. Let's see all the variety that rosé is. Because right now, you know, we don't expect all red wine to taste the same.
True.
We don't expect all white wine to taste the same. Mm-hmm. But we seem to think rosé should all taste the same. And that would be sad.
Mm-hmm. Right. So we want to embrace the variety, try different types and styles from different regions, made from different grapes. And that will kind of keep us on the right track. Yes.
Yeah, and France now, which is the only country drinking more rosé than us, a third of the wine they drink is pink. They drink more rosé than white wine, which was unimaginable a decade ago. Okay. So maybe we're just starting on our rosé path here.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's toast to that. So thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. I so appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Of course. And we've covered a lot. We've covered the current rise of rosé, the factors that led into it. We talked about some great resources, Wine Spectator, the magazine, and winespectator.com, and also the app. What was the name of the app again?
Wine Ratings Plus.
Wonderful. And I will also link that up in the show notes. And to everybody listening, please be sure to check out Mitch's Rosé's New Era article in the current issue of Wine Spectator. It really is such a great read. And again, I will include all the resources on my website, and you can go to theglamorousgourmet.com/episode12. So thanks again for joining me. And yeah, well, I hope to talk to you again soon about one of the other many topics that you write about.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Cheers.
Cheers.